Today on Hobby Farms Presents Growing Good, you're getting to hear from Robert Frew and Juan Carlos Arango. At Sober Mesa Farm, just outside Bloomington, Indiana, Robert and Juan Carlos are practicing permaculture to grow food for themselves and a whole community of eaters. With a focus on abundance and sharing, they host multicultural educational opportunities, employment for refugees, and offer the farm as a space for others to connect with the natural worlds. Hello, Robert and Juan Carlos.
Hello, Lisa.
Hello. Thank you so much for wanting to come on this podcast. I love Bloomington and Monroe County, Indiana, and I visit the area a few times a year. And I've had a couple of chances to visit with you all too. And I just really admire your interest in sharing what you've built and bringing others into that. And I'm just excited that you want to talk about all that today.
Thank you. We are
Yeah.
too. Thank you. Yeah, we're looking forward.
Great. I guess to start off, can you tell us about Sober Mesa Farm and how it got started?
Well, Sober Mesa Farm got started basically in 2013. We bought the land in 2012. We needed some time to see the land through all four seasons, and that would help us make some decisions about what it was that we thought was possible to put on this piece of land to grow on it, where the water moved across the land and the light and how the soil was different in parts of it. Which would help us to make decisions about where we were going to plant things and how we could sort of slow down and capture water as it moved across the land. So we started the farm, as I mentioned, around 2013, and we actually had our first growing season then where we opened it up to the community in 2014. During that period prior to that, we had really focused a lot on deciding what sort of perennials that we were going to bring here. We had to find the places to buy them from, develop new relationships with a lot of people from outside of this area, in Kentucky and Southern Indiana. And through those relationships, we learned a lot about what was successful in this area and what, these different landscape providers could offer us or nurseries could offer us as far as stock that we could try here on this site and hopefully have some success with it.
I would also add an overall perspective because when we started this, we really didn't know much about farming. We came from really learning and volunteering with wildlife through the Wildlife Federation. So, and by coincidence, Bloomington had the Bioneers Conference, like around 2010, something like that. And we met Peter Bain and Keith Johnson at the conference, and we learned about permaculture. So, and I think that's a big component of our farm. So it was designed based on permaculture, and Keith helped with the first layout of the farm. So that really shaped the beginning of the farm.
Yeah, I love that you all actually took the time to let the land be for a year and to do the observation and to be really thoughtful about it, because every book that you read and every, bit of advice that you hear when you're starting with a new piece of land, people say, like, give it a year and observe. And who does that? Like, nobody does that because we're all so impatient and just want to get things started. And so I'm glad that you all did that. And it seems to me that that has served you really well, that you've been able to set up this system that works for you.
Yeah, that really helped for sure.
When you're at this Bioneers conference, what was it about permaculture that appealed to you all? And I guess what does that look like in practice now on your farm?
So that's a good question. For me, I don't know about Robert, but for me, it was the part that mimics nature. So, and at the same time, it was a challenge because really to understand nature is quite impossible, I would say. I mean, I don't know if everybody understands nature, but observing nature and trying to do what is important at the moment and let the in this case the land to really do most of the work, I think that was a crucial part for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some experience because of the natives, you know, practicing with it. So it somehow was really much the same. So, yeah, I don't know about for you, Robert.
Yeah, I think that the thing that attracted me the most maybe was this idea that you could grow food, you could have the trees and bushes that were producing fruit for people, consequently for wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a lot of beauty at the same time, which we both came from this idea. We wanted a forest woodland, which we had. We were successful at that, at the other place that we had before. And we wanted to bring some of those same ideas with us to this new piece of land. But we had the idea that this was quite different. We weren't coming to a woodland. We left one, and now we were coming to the space that was quite open to full sunlight. And they didn't have water.
Aha. Uh-huh. So I think the timing of this conversation is interesting because here we're talking about working with nature and that you were intentional about observing how water moves across your land and how to keep the water on the land. I don't know if listeners can hear this. I just heard thunder. And I know when we first hopped on this call, you said that the past few days you've had some wicked weather, tornado warnings and everything. I guess, how do you feel like your land has been able to absorb the really wild changing weather that we're getting? And I know in your area, you guys get some terrifying storms.
Yes. You know, Lisa, let me sort of clarify a little bit because I might have been a bit misleading with that sort of brief stop about the water. So really what I was referring to is that we did not have access to municipal water or to a well here. We're in an area where we have a lot of limestone deposits. So the possibility of a well in the area was not good. We got with the Geological Survey through Indiana University and the state. We looked at those maps, and there wasn't much success in this area for having a well. So we gave up on that idea. The problem with the municipal water was that there was water just directly across the street from us, and the neighbors had water on the same side of the road we were on. But this piece of land here, and the next 9 acres to us, which is when we first found the land, we bought both pieces. There was no access to that water line out in front. In other words, the water company wasn't willing to sell us access, would not sell us meters to access that line because they said it was maxed out.
Aha.
So we knew that when we bought the land. But we thought we could figure a way around it with our kind of throwing our coins in the pond, which
no
wasn't
kidding.
Here yet, and or in the fountain. And so we said, well, let's just throw caution to the wind and hope that we will get this figured out. Because, of course, we got the land at a cheaper price because we didn't have access to a form of reliable municipal or well water.
Yeah. This is an undertaking that I feel like most people would have walked away from. So even now, do you still not have municipal water? You collect all of the water that you use?
Yeah, we do. But let me finish that story briefly. It's a long story,
yeah.
Lisa.
Oh.
And I know we may have finished done, but it was a lesson for those of us who are getting involved in farming and really understanding about water rights in the United States.
Mm.
And it was a journey for us of almost a year to figure this out. We had to go to the Capitol, to the regulatory commission. Every state has one. They can help you understand what the regulations are about access to water in the community where you live, and particularly in rural areas where you have to depend upon a small organization that is like a water board. And they manage mm-hmm. that. They make decisions about their rates and who gets water and how you get it and things like that. So we had to attend some of those meetings with the board and figure out why it was that we couldn't have access and how we could work around that, what their justifications were for it. And through that journey, we really learned that if you are an empowered landowner, you can go down a path of trying to figure these things out yourself. And in the end, you may have to have the help of a lawyer, but only in a very small way. And because we had done most of the footwork, we had done most of the research. And so it really came down to figuring out what was the reason that they couldn't give us the water and how could we work around that? What study could they do to see if that line could be tapped into and could withstand another couple of connections or more?
Mm-hmm.
And after many negotiations back and forth, it started with us paying $40,000 to install a new main to doing a research on the line with a hydrologist, which was going to be, how much was that? 9,000 or
6,000?
That was going to be 6,000. So we didn't go along with either of those ideas. And so that's when we said, well, we better bring in a lawyer for the end of this and let's see if we can finally close the deal. And we
wow.
did. I think, you know, our saving grace was that although we could not purchase a meter from others who held the meters, because this often happens in rural areas,
right,
that old families will buy up extra meters and they will hold on to those for future generations. And that water line that runs along the road will only sustain so many attachments to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's based upon, and that is the determination of how many meters are available for sale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
wow.
Through that line of thought, that's how we finally got to the end of seeing that, oh yes, they could attach 9 more meters and we got 2 of them.
Wow. Good for you for sticking that out.
Yeah, but we did pursue the continuation of looking for other water sources, rainwater sources that we could collect on ground level, beneath ground level, and through large tanks to collect water. So we really have those three systems in place, and we do depend upon those heavily on the land. And that sort of collecting of water, slowing it down as it moved across the land, as we planted, in very particular patterns, which captured more water. Then 2 springs arose on the property, which weren't here, at least when we bought it. And so that was, proof, I think, for us that we were doing the right thing with, mm-hmm. when it came to water.
Mm-hmm.
And that, which is incredible, it didn't take that long. On the second year, we already, or we could see the results of holding water, infiltration, etc. We watered the trees the first year. After that, we never watered the tree.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really great that you can see the results of your good work that quickly.
Yeah, it was really, really, how do you say, easy to observe and to get the results. Because sometimes things, both with some practice, it takes a good while, but no, this was quite fast.
Yeah, cool. Last time that we talked, Juan Carlos, you said, we love volunteers. And I thought this was really funny because when you said that, you meant both people and also plants. And so I'm wondering, on your farm, this sort of, I mean, this fits in with the idea, with the concept of permaculture. What does volunteers look like on your farm?
So at the beginning, we read all the books that, you know, people show you or suggest you, Edu Coleman or Jean-Marc Pain.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, those big names. And they give you some ideas. But, you know, after you start farming year after year, And you see the amount of work you have to put into that, and always you start buying seeds, buying inputs. So is that you become kind of a dependent on many exterior, you know, resources. So when we heard about other ways to farm, especially when we met our big teacher and mentor, Jairo Restrepo. So we started to shift a little to see how we could farm in a more organic way. And meaning, so if you see, or if you let some of your plants to go through the whole cycle, meaning they bloom, they provide seeds, and they release the seeds in the soil, you end up having a lot of seedlings. I mean, a lot. Mm-hmm. And when you transplant those, you notice that those are healthier and more resilient in comparison to the ones you just buy and plant. Mm-hmm. And less diseases and problems to the weather. So we are starting doing that. And we have really great results from that. So that's what I said. We love volunteers because mm-hmm. they give their best to you. And you just need to care about them. You move them to a specific bed. We do a lot of companion planting. And so you save time and money that way.
Yeah, hyper local seed saving. But the plants are just doing their own work. What are some of the plants that have reseeded themselves like this for you?
We're done with brassicas. With some of the, like, even tomatoes. We eat a lot of berries, a variety from Colombia, with shiso. The shiso is becoming almost a weed, mm-hmm, but it's mm-hmm. so valuable for us because we use it for teas or for cooking. Different varieties of lettuce too. What all this we? Yeah, I think that's pretty much. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Even some of the that's potatoes. Great. This year, a lot of potatoes came back, which we didn't. They were going to a good amount of potatoes. Maybe we didn't harvest well then.
Uh-huh. That's fantastic. I love this idea. What else are you growing and raising there in terms of animals and crops?
Well, so with the animals, also it was a journey to understand how to work with them. Because at the beginning, you know, you learn the importance of having animals in the whole system, but we didn't know much about animals. And so we started to give them roles, let's put it that way. So, but like workers too. Mm-hmm. And so we got guineas because when we bought the land, there were tons of ticks. Oh. And we knew they are good for that. And also they provide eggs, plus the manure, of course. We, of course, chickens too, because we like the eggs and we wanted to sell eggs. Then goats, we had the dream to have milk from the goats, but that implies other things, so we didn't have the time. So now they really provide the manure, which we use for our input, and also manage the pasture. Ducks are great also, like the guineas. They go through the orchards and they do a good job with pets and also providing the manure and also the manure, I mean, and the eggs. Cats, we were growing strawberries, and the chipmunks are cute as hell, but also very destructive. So uh-huh. or we get the berries for ourselves and for customers, or we just grow them for the chipmunks. So we brought the cats and they're dealing with the chipmunks, voles, mice, rabbits too. Mm-hmm. And pretty much we have bees, but we have tons of native bees, but we wanted honey. And I'm missing something or not.
Okay, so I think you covered all the animals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. And I like that everyone has a job, that it's not like they just get to come along and be cute, like you said. Everyone has a purpose there.
And we say, Lisa, we don't eat our workers, so we allow them to do whatever they want, and we really value the importance of the contribution to the system. Mm-hmm. And so we don't raise animals for meat. It's just to really balance the whole little ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I know in terms of the crops that you grow, you lots of standard sort of Midwest American crops, but also you do some interesting things that a lot of folks don't do. What are some of the what are some of the things that you're growing there? I mean, you could talk about the normal things too, but I'm especially curious to hear about the things that we think of as more unusual.
Yeah, so you know, I am from Colombia, so of course I need my tropical, and mm-hmm. we have a greenhouse, so we have some citruses there. We had avocados. We lost them in 2017 when we had a huge climate event here, and you know, greenhouse was frozen. And we have passion fruit, soursop, and pitanga. That's a tree from Brazil. And I'm missing more. Oh, bananas. We ate bananas last year. Delicious.
That's so cool.
And the avocado competition. So, and outside on the orchard, we have, and we try to grow fruit that they are on other part of the planet with similar conditions, and they are thriving here, like jujubes, chess. We are growing also other quince too in medlars. Mm-hmm. And we are experimenting this year or expanding the experiment with grain. Mm-hmm. We grow rice. We are growing more this year. We're going to try lentils, different kind of dry beans like azuki. Mainly we use them also for cooking. We grow also an amilpa system, so we incorporate different kinds of beans and all kinds of plants with the corn. We have kiwis right now. They are forming fruit, which we are really looking forward to, those delicious kiwis. We are growing Japanese ginger, yoga, different kind of herbs, to epazote, Chinese chrysanthemums.
I think that's fantastic. I don't know anyone who's growing soursop or bananas in a greenhouse in this region. So that's very cool. And also this idea of the grain milpa. I've been reading about this. I feel like people are talking about it more, that this is a traditional indigenous way of growing crops. I know there is thought behind it, but it's sort of a mix of different grains all at once. You all had a fellowship with Midwest Grains, is that right?
That was last year. Ended 2 weeks ago, unfortunately. It was a really great experience. Mm-hmm. And we learned a lot. Yeah, we got inspired to even do more grains here at the farm. We have the how you say, challenge, obviously, because our terrain is not flat. That's why we're using the terracing system. And also, because the farm is so packed, we cannot use big machinery. So we are looking into systems that they use in Asia or South America. And we'll see. We will report about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because I mean, I grow dry beans, but just like 50 row feet of them, you know, a year, nothing on like a larger scale. And I mean, harvesting that is a commitment.
Oh, yeah. That's when volunteers also are really handy.
Yeah. Right, for sure. Yeah, how do you go about distributing all of these crops that you're growing?
Well, the model, Lisa, that we started with really was a CSA model, and we also had opened the farm up to customers to come on Sundays to have a market here on a day that didn't compete with other markets going on in the region. So we thought it would be a nice thing for people after they, you know, have their Sunday morning ritual, whatever that might be. And got, you know, the farm open for families to come, and the kids always enjoyed seeing the animals. So that would seem like a pretty viable way to bring more people in and let them see what we're doing here. And then here in 2023, the USDA really provided funding through monies that were given through the COVID fund to states to use it for, in Indiana at least, it was used for, one track was for women, infants, and children through the WIC program. And the other track was to be used for BIPOC growers and producers throughout the state, and to give them mini contracts. And some were paid up front, which is what we got, where it gave you a better opportunity to upscale your operation, to hire more labor, and expand where and what you were growing and how much. So that was quite helpful in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, scaling up is a dream that a lot of farmers have. So that allowed you to grow more, sell at more markets, or sell to more markets, not at that you don't physically go to a farmer's market.
Actually, how that money was earmarked was that we would get the money up front, and with the food that we grew, we would then take that food and attribute that value of that food to the money that we had received up front, and we would donate it then to a local pantry.
Oh, fantastic.
It was really a win-win situation for us and for the pantries. It was a great way for us to really push forward this whole idea that we have about nutrient-dense food and how beneficial that can be to your health. Into your overall well-being, and that the people that needed it the most were often people that had the least access to it.
Mm-hmm.
So taking the food to pantries and seeing the volunteers' expressions there when we brought that beautiful food, it was really the same grade and quality of food that you would be delivering to your CSA members in the same day that you harvested it.
Mm-hmm.
So we were not bringing second or unsellable food, which is often what these pantries end up with. And sometimes clients that come in really feel like, you know, they are getting a handout because look at what they're actually getting. And they know that it's not the same type of food that they're seeing at a food store that they would probably prefer to have access to. So that's how it was a win-win for both of us. The consumer and us, the grower, and these pantries as well. I think it was encouraging for them to see the and to be able to offer a quality of food that they often don't have access to.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of USDA money coming out right now to go to various organizations to help farmers scale up and to provide more food access. And there's a lot of grants right now for climate smart activities as well. So it's an interesting thing to watch small scale farmers be able to get involved in these and then have the opportunity to grow from there. Are there any challenges that you experienced in scaling up or any growing pains that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I think that I can only speak for Indiana, but I'm guessing we were not alone in. There were probably other states that experienced some of the similar issues that Indiana did. And that was that it was a new program for the state to roll out. And in Indiana, it was done through the Indiana Department of Health versus the Indiana Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how that was done in other states, but because of the lack of experience in managing funds in this way, getting them to BIPOC growers and producers versus getting them through the WIC program, which they already had a system in place for that for many, many years. I think that that left a lot of loopholes, and that created uncertainty for not just for the growers, but for others around the state who were perhaps in charge of these funds and really knowing the importance of following all the regulations that were wrapped around how the monies could be spent and how to educate the farmers about how those monies could be spent. And generally for most people, certainly for us, everything when it's written, it's much easier to go back to versus a lot of verbal descriptions of things.
Oh, yeah.
So I would always say that it's a good idea to go to a lawyer, your lawyer, and say, you know, this is really an investment for us and we better make sure we're doing it right. And take the contract that you get, no matter who it comes from, and share it with a lawyer and let them go over it because they're really working in your best interest. And had we done that with this, we would have came out with a very different end product.
Mm. Kind of switching gears from farming to some of this other work that you all do. Educating people is really important to both of you, I know. Do you want to talk about the educational component of your work and the workshops that you offer, and also just the way that you interact with your customer base about this food and how it's grown and how to use it?
Absolutely. So I would speak about two big things here. So, I mean, we love food and we learn a lot about food and the importance for all the ones, you know, in this planet. And so our customers are really important to us, and we do our best to provide a really high nutrient food to them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in order to do that, you have to start from the base, which is the soil, all the biology, and et cetera, that, you know. So if you don't know much about it, you know, you have to inform yourself. You have to reach out and learn. So through our journey, we understand that a lot of people are in the same situation or where or are or will be in the same situation as. And when we found people that have, for some reason, marked our lives, I think it's important to share that with others. So that's what we try to do. We bring people to the farm for us to continue learning, but to share that knowledge with others that are on the same, you know, journey, let's put it that way. So we try every year to have different workshops here at the farm. Also, we bring schools, mostly elementary, or we open the farm to them through a different program for the kids to see the farm, the animals, how we grow the food. They can taste the food, understand the importance of soil, microbiology, and et cetera. So that way, they grow up already, you know, with the fear of microbes. On the contrary, loving them, because we need those. I tell the kids they are ancestors, so we have to really embrace them. And so, and now for farmers, like this Jairo Restrepo already mentioned before, he is an agronomist from Colombia, but he travels all over the world teaching these practices and giving the farmer the power to make their own input, to start to, you know, understand the farming, break out from the big system to buy and buy input. So they could use whatever they have available, improve it, and make your own input.
The inputs are, we're talking like compost and other amendments?
Yes. So Jairo, he always based his whole teaching on three, he calls that the three M's. So microorganisms, minerals and organic matter. So when he makes all the inputs, he has that in mind. So for example, for the compost, we don't make compost, but we make through fertilization, like a soil amendment, let's put it that way, that ferments into wheat and is really rich in microbiology. And it has really turned this farm, how would you say, Robert, in, I don't know, in half, before Bokashi and after Bokashi.
Oh.
Because, it's incredible what it does. So, of course, keeping the soil cover, you could overgreen, so, I mean, green covers or any kind of plant, always have the soil alive with plants and biology. Also, we use seeds to complement foliar nutrition to the plants if needed. And yeah, I think that's pretty much. But I mean, he has, if there are extremes, of course, people are dealing with pests or diseases. So he has other recipes for saying something that he calls broth, and they are based on nutrition. So it's no like synthetic fertilizers or pesticides or herbicides or those sites. It's all based on nutrition. So the plants really take the nutrients and they improve their immune system and they have.
That's great. So I know you had a workshop with Jairo last year. When is your next workshop with him?
We brought him last time in August, but this year we are going to have him here in September for 4 days again. Mm-hmm. It's from September 3rd through the 6th. And this time he's going to teach again about those inputs. Also, a big component, new component this year is going to be about grazing animals, how to improve your soil and your pastures in order to, you know, have healthier, whatever, cows or goats or sheep, whatever you are using for grazing, and or even chickens too. And the last one, he teaches tests that could be used for soil or sap or sap. It's called chromatography. It's a test that gives you quick results about over picture of the health of, in our case, the soil. We use it here for soil mostly. And it's a qualitative test. It's not quantitative. So if you do all the soil tests, for example, you could combine both. And I think it's a good way to see what you have in the soil.
Fantastic. I know nothing about chromatography, but I read a little bit about it after you all told me about Jairo probably last year. I think it's really interesting. And so I hope someone listening will consider coming to this. Also, back to what I said in the beginning, Bloomington, Indiana, Monroe County, Indiana, beautiful place in September. So people should really consider this.
I would say, Lisa, if you're into farming and you are growing organically, or you want to go and transition to organic, Hire will give you a lot of great tools to support that transition or to improve your farm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's really valuable. And the ones who came last year, we have professors and researchers, and they were all amazed. Yeah, and he if you look at him, he's gone to Europe, Africa, Australia, all over South America, except in the United States. So this is the second year that he's been in Indiana, or he will be. The first time he came to Atlanta in 2019, that's when I met him in person. But I've been following him since 2016.
Cool. That's great. What's up next for Sobre Mesa Farm, or what are you all dreaming about for the future, kind of near or far?
Lots of things. So going back to education, I think we would love the farm to work with scientists to develop programs together from the practical and the science, because I think it's really beneficial, especially what now that we're encountering so many challenges with the climate. So that's one of the things we want to do more. We want to continue experimenting with new and crazy ideas. What is probably in mind?
Yeah, I think, Lisa, overall, the goal at the farm and really for permaculture in general is that you're trying to keep up with the changes that are happening in the climate. And how can you grow into the climate as it moves and changes? How do you adapt to that on a small scale farm? And it's really this proliferation of small scale farms is not going to stop. I think that it will continue to grow. I think that the USDA will continue to provide more funding, more assistance, more help through their various offices, the NRCS, FSA, and find more value in small scale farms and what they can actually bring to the local food scene. And really, it's also about transportation of food. I mean, that becomes quite expensive across the country. Different regions are really in the sight hairs of climate change more than some others. And they're experiencing more extreme conditions. So I think the Midwest is in a fairly good place on the planet to continue growing food, although what we grow is shifting and when we grow it is changing. This year we're really about 2 weeks ahead with the blooming of so many fruits and different crops that were ready 2 weeks early, which can be a challenge when you don't have the funding in place or the purchaser agreement in place in time to meet those changes in when your food is ready for market. So, I think that we're trying to grow into this idea of being more flexible and finding ways this year and next year to continue expanding what the farm does. We have an idea in mind about an incubator project on the next 9 acres next to us. And we have it somewhat set up now to get started. We just have to find funding to help support the project, which really we want to utilize the local population of refugees who are in Bloomington now and give them an opportunity to grow food, hopefully assist them in creating contracts with the state to sell their excess food. And just give them an opportunity to get away from some of their traditional places that they end up finding employment in and rather get to a place of healing, which is out on the land. And so many of them came from places where they were really escaping very bad conditions and coming to a place where they could actually grow food, have their hands in the soil. I can't think of anything better than that.
For
Yeah.
sure.
And some of them are farmers, so.
Yeah, fantastic. One last thing, kind of quick. The name of your farm, Sobre Mesa Farm, can you explain what that is?
So it took a while for us to find a name. And so, again, I'm Latino, and we have that word that is sobre mesa. It means that, Latinos love to talk. And so after each meal, we used to, that's changing, unfortunately, but the whole family or with friends or whatever, stay at the table chatting for hours, drinking coffee. And so that whole thing was called sobremesa. So let's have the sobremesa. And you bring some desserts or coffee and you continue at the table talking about whatever you want to talk. So we thought that name was going to be perfect for us because it's about food, it's about community. We bring people to the farm, we share our ideas, we ask about the ideas, it's a place for all the people to meet. So it's been a great place to do sobremesa.
Yeah. Sometimes you have to create community around you. And it's not always just to integrate yourself into one. So we decided we would create a place where we sort of made community happen.
Well, I think you all have done that. And I appreciate you both so much and appreciate your work and your farm. How can other folks learn more about you?
We have a website. We are not much into social media. I love taking pictures. So if they want to see nice, I would say, things about the farm, we have an Instagram. So it's Sobremesa on Instagram. And I don't say much. I just put pictures or small videos there. But we have a website, sobremesafarm.com. And yeah, I think we don't have YouTube. We don't have anything like that. It's just images or the website, people website.
Fantastic. I will link to those from your show notes so people can find you easily. Juan Carlos and Robert, thank you so much for sharing all of this today.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, this has been great. Yeah.
It was a pleasure.